If you're anything like me several months ago, you may have never heard of civil forfeiture. Maybe you've watched John Oliver's viral critique, which sparked public debate about the issue. In this episode, we'll explore what civil forfeiture is, how it operates in Canada, and some of the key arguments both for and against its use. Good morning, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Geffen Spill. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is on civil forfeiture. This is a topic I came across earlier this year during my first year in law school, and one I could not stop learning more about. So, what is civil forfeiture? Well, let's start with its foundation. Before we start the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. This podcast contains general discussions of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Most crime is motivated by profit. That's what politicians across Canada, the UK, and other jurisdictions seem to think. They propose giving provincial governments the power to seize private property from people through a civil proceeding without them having to be convicted of a crime. You might be more familiar with criminal forfeiture. As part of the sentencing process, the Crown can move to seize your assets if there is a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. These are called in personam proceedings because it is the accused that is on trial. On the other hand, civil forfeiture takes us out of the world of criminal law into civil proceedings where the government can bring an action against the private property itself and seize it if they can show on a balance of probabilities that it was involved in or is the proceed of a crime. Now, it is possible you're already thinking about the pros and cons of such a policy. On the one hand, you may be thinking about how this helps governments fight crime. On the other hand, you may be thinking of some of the potential constitutional and due process concerns that arise from enacting such a statute in Canada. My research led me to ask the following question: does the current Canadian civil forfeiture scheme appropriately balance crime deterrence and individual rights so that its efficacy justifies possible intrusions on those rights? Academics on this topic have seemingly identified a sort of two-pronged problem that animates the civil forfeiture debate. First, per some critics, civil forfeiture has the potential to interfere with the principles of due process and infringe on the rights of property owners to the enjoyment of their property, with limited protections for innocent parties. Second, the efficacy of civil forfeiture in achieving its objectives of crime deterrence may be unclear and difficult to measure. So, what's in store for you throughout this podcast to help you understand where these conclusions come from? First, we will examine the policy rationales that proponents of civil forfeiture rely on to justify its use. Second, we will examine the criticisms surrounding due process concerns and property rights. Finally, we will examine whether civil forfeiture has actually been successful in achieving its goal. Before we get into all that, I want to clarify again that this podcast is an effort to gather information regarding both sides of the debate and present you, the listener, with as much information as possible to decide where you stand. So let's start with the policy rationales. Jeffrey Simser, an expert on the topic, has published extensively on civil forfeiture and has outlined some of these rationales in his work. Of course, the primary goal of civil forfeiture is deterrence, and it seems rational that crime is motivated by profit. This is grounded in the belief that property obtained through unlawful activity should not be held by and accumulate in the hands of people who commit unlawful activity. Since profit is often the motivating factor behind unlawful activity, a lower standard for the forfeiture of the profits and instruments of crime will make prospective wrongdoers think twice before breaking the law. One of the most interesting supports for the use of civil forfeiture and the lower standard of proof is combating organized crime, specifically the goal being to bring the leaders of organized crime to justice. Leaders of organized crime protect themselves by having foot soldiers carry out incriminating tasks, allowing them to enjoy the profits of crime without the threat of conviction-based forfeiture. Civil forfeiture, on the other hand, allows governments to go after the profits and avoid the barriers to conviction that these organized crime leaders create for themselves. So, I don't know about you, but some of these rationales do sound promising to me. So why is there a debate about the topic? This brings us to our next segment, the criticisms of civil forfeiture. Many scholars, including Michelle Gallant and Colin King, have delved into some of the negative consequences that these laws have. I'll be focusing on two of them today and examining some case law: the harms to due process and the concerns over the property rights of individuals. Let's start with due process. At the heart of this concern is the difference between the criminal beyond a reasonable doubt standard and the civil balance of probability standard. Aaron Felmeth makes this concern pretty clear, stating that the result is to ensure the efficient control of private behavior without the need to honor such pesky rights as the guarantees against double jeopardy and excessive fines, and most importantly, the requirement that the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. So what do his concerns really look like in practice? The application of the lower standard may interfere with due process in several ways. First, the Crown may easily prove its case with evidence that would be insufficient in a criminal proceeding. This includes the opinion evidence of experts or law enforcement that could not, on their own, satisfy the beyond a reasonable doubt requirement. Also, since civil forfeiture proceedings occur separately from the criminal ones, the seizing of property under the civil proceeding may undermine acquittals from criminal trials in previous proceedings. Picture this: an accused is acquitted for a drug offense in a criminal trial, but the government then seizes his house or his car through civil forfeiture. Will society still view him as innocent? Canadian courts have actually commented on this concern, with Justice Corbett in Ontario v. Cole Watson holding that an in personam judgment that binds the Crown conclusively decides the in rem question. What he's essentially saying here is that the criminal proceeding decides the civil proceeding, and that the courts have the tools to prevent the government from seizing property through civil forfeiture after an acquittal has been issued in the criminal trial, holding that the acquittal will not be undermined because of those tools. This case was actually cited by the Supreme Court in Chatterjee, which is the only civil forfeiture case to make it to the Supreme Court. The court stated that res judicata, the doctrine that prevents the relitigation of matters already decided by the court, along with other tools, were all arguments available to property owners to challenge civil proceedings that follow criminal acquittals. It seems that the judges recognized a due process issue with the administration of the Civil Remedies Act when criminal forfeiture acquittal was previously issued, but concluded that this is a matter that can be addressed by the courts, as it was in Cole Watson. With Canadian courts seemingly satisfied that the due process critiques of civil forfeiture may be adequately addressed through legal tools, let's examine the concerns over property rights of individuals. Before examining the property rights concerns, it is important to note that Canada actually does not have constitutionally protected property rights, while the US does. This limits the ability of critics of civil forfeiture or property owners who have had their property seized to challenge that decision on constitutional grounds. Even though this is the case, it is still worthwhile to examine some of the property rights concerns. First, forfeiture may take away from the property rights of innocent parties, including joint tenants, business partners, lien holders, or buyers who purchased the property without knowledge of its use in unlawful activity or its origins from such activity. The Supreme Court actually held that there is no need for proof that a property owner themselves committed a crime. They provided the following example, which I find pretty helpful. A drug dealer may gift the proceeds of a drug sale to charity, and that money may be the subject of civil forfeiture, even after the charity becomes its owner. However, It is also important to note that there are some measures in civil forfeiture legislation to protect innocent parties. The Ontario legislation, for example, provides that where a property owner can prove that they are an uninvolved interest holder in the property, the court can make orders to protect their interests. Another concern is that even if a party is not completely innocent of the offense, there may be disproportionate impact on the accused and their family if their home or other important property is seized. This concerns critics, especially when they consider that the balance of probabilities is a low bar to create this potentially devastating impact on the life of the accused. Think smaller crimes leading to very large punishments. Okay, so we've covered a lot so far. We've heard about the pros of civil forfeiture, and we've just now discussed briefly some of the cons. Now, the real question is, do the ends justify the means? Does civil forfeiture sufficiently achieve crime deterrence and reduce criminal profits to justify these negative impacts? The answer is, we don't really know. R.T. Naylor argues that it is very difficult to measure the efficacy of civil forfeiture in deterring crime, making it difficult to justify in light of the negative consequences. First, there are no clear criteria to measure the success of civil forfeiture. The metric of total seized assets by police, which is often cited as a metric for the success of civil forfeiture, is sometimes used to misrepresent the success of the legislation, which in reality is not a true reflection. Naylor argues that the increase in assets seized by police does not lead to the conclusion that there is less criminal activity, because the total criminal economy may continue to expand. Further, seized assets are not the objective to be measured, but rather they are the tool that the government claims deters crime in the first place. Only the input of seized assets is evident in that figure, not the output of reduced crime. Reduced crime is the objective, and total seized assets just does not reflect that. Naylor also argues that the psychology of crime is more complex than something that is just motivated by profits. The view that criminals are only motivated by profits is an oversimplification of criminal motivation, according to him. Criminal motivation is a complex mix of psychological, social, and economic factors. So even if we could find that civil forfeiture makes crime less profitable, that does not necessarily mean it will deter it. So where does that leave us, the listeners? Is civil forfeiture justified? This is a difficult question to answer without proof of its efficacy in deterring crime and making it less profitable. Many are concerned with the negative consequences of these laws, and that concern makes sense. I mean, the idea that governments have powers to essentially execute criminal law objectives through civil proceedings does go against our traditional view of due process. However, the Supreme Court did hold that Ontario's statute is constitutional, despite arguments that it touches on the federal government's criminal law powers. So it is possible that the due process issue and concern of critics is actually settled from a legal perspective. On the other hand, administering civil forfeiture law cases while balancing due process may be difficult to do in practice, especially since social stigma does not always respect the distinctions between cases against an individual accused and cases against their property. Maybe we can strike a balance between the two sides of the argument if there are more robust protections for innocent party owners in the legislation and some guardrails to prevent the seizing of essential property, such as someone's home, for less serious offenses. This is a debate that has spanned decades and will likely continue to animate discussions about criminal deterrence and individual rights. I hope this episode gave you a glimpse into a topic that I find fascinating and has given you a foundation to decide where you stand on the issue. I'm your host, Geffen Spill. If you like this episode, you could find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website. Thank you for listening.